Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello, I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and today I'm in a glorious sunny room at Eton. Yes, Eton the school, with the current provost, who's also had one of the most exciting and varied careers, alongside finding time to travel extensively, raise a family of four, and write well over a dozen books. Installed as provost of Eton last September, Nicholas Coleridge is also the chairman of historic royal palaces. He was previously the supremo at Condé Nast for just over 30 years, where he sped through the ranks from editorial director to president of Condé Nast International, overseeing all its titles from Vogue to Tatler and World of Interiors. He went on to become chair of the Victoria and Albert Museum and was awarded a knighthood in 2022 for services to museums, publishing and the creative industries. He has done so much more besides that to squeeze it all into an introduction would take up the better part of our time together. So without further ado, Sir Nicholas Coleridge, a very warm welcome to Radio Oldie.
Well, that's very, very kind of you, Charlotte.
Now, before we get on to talking about Eton, can we go back to the beginning? You have, of course, given a fairly extensive account of your life in your wonderful 2019 memoir. Is that right? 2019?
The Glossy Years. Yes, it did come out in 2019. Yes.
But for the benefit of our listeners who haven't read it, can we start at the beginning? Tell us a bit about your upbringing and how you found your way so quickly into journalism.
Well, I don't come from a journalistic family. Whilst people always refer to Samuel Taylor Coleridge, the poet, and thus assume that we're a strongly literary family, but we're not really, actually. My father worked in Lloyd's of London, and my mother looked after us. I'm starting to sound like Meghan Markle by editing out the existence of a nanny, but there was one of those.
I've got two brothers,
Timmy and Christopher. Tim, who worked in London in finance, and my brother Christopher, who lives in Los Angeles. And we grew up in London, just off the King's Road, and we had a house in West Sussex. I went to a prep school called Ashdown House, famous for also being the prep school that produced such luminaries as Boris Johnson and Andrew Mitchell MP and others. Eddie Redmayne, I think, was also there. I was there for 5 years. And then I came, in that sense of full circle, to where I have now returned. I came to Eton. I arrived at this school as a not terribly bright boy at all. In fact, it's rather an odd thing that anyone who knew me in my first 2 years at Eton and was in any class that I was in remembers me as someone who was always in the bottom streams at the school. And then a very, very lovely thing happened, because when one was able to drop the subjects that I was bad at, which was probably two-thirds of them, and was only left with three for A-levels, I suddenly did better. I did history, English and divinity. I owe a lot, actually, to Eton, because a lot of the things that were to become key in my life, the things that I found that I enjoyed doing, were things that I learned here. I became very keen on debating. I was very keen on schoolboy journalism and edited the Chronicle with Craig Brown and others. I enjoyed running societies and getting speakers to come down. So those were probably the three things that I really learnt to do at Eton, and which became the basis of the kind of things that I liked doing afterwards. Actually, I was reminded the other day of debating here, and I was in the team. There was a team, and the other three people in it were very distinguished in that they were Oliver Letwin, who, of course, went on to be in the cabinet, and Charles Moore, who went on to edit the Telegraphs and the Spectator and write the Thatcher book, and Craig Brown, the great satirist. And we got into the finals against Wickham Abbey, the famous girls' school.
No.
And
I hope they beat you.
Well, I'm very sorry to say that they did, but we will come to that. They did. And we travelled over in a minibus. And as we came close to Wickham Abbey, which I'd never seen before, but if anyone knows it, it has a very long wall round it, miles-long wall. And there was a man who was raising the wall. And when we got there, I said to the headmistress who met us on the doorstep, I said, I see you're making the wall a bit higher. And she said, we most certainly are. We had a most regrettable incident recently when three local lads from the town brought a lorry along and stood on the roof and jeered and wolf whistled at our girls who were playing lacrosse. So I told the governing body we had no alternative but to build the wall higher, and that is what is happening. Anyway, we went into this competition. I can remember Oliver giving an incredibly clever intellectual speech, standing the motion on its head in the most clever way, and all the judges, of which there were 12, looking baffled. And then the girls gave their brilliant speeches. And at the end, they all had to vote, the judges, one by one, like the old Eurovision Song Contest. And all 12 voted for Wickham Abbey, and we lost 12-0. Nice. And then we got back in our van and came back, and I wish I could tell you that we were all terribly embarrassed. Of course we weren't. We were just howling with laughter all the way and impersonating it. But they were happy days. And then I did okay in my A-levels, and I couldn't decide what to do. I didn't know where I wanted to go. And I remember I was sitting in the school pub here, which is called Tap, talking to Charles Moore. And he said, why don't you go try for Trinity Cambridge? He said, didn't you do theology for A-level? Absolutely no one applies for theology, he stated. He said, there are 5 indentured teachers who've got endowed places teaching theology. And at the moment, they only have 1 pupil. I wrote in and I went to Trinity to be interviewed. Gosh, you will see at once what a long time ago this is, and how different it was to today. I went to see Bishop John Robinson, who was the head of theology in Trinity, and we talked together for an hour about the course and things. And at the end of it, he said, well, I think you're going to fit in very well here. Welcome to Trinity. And I went out into a sunny quadrangle, and I thought, gosh, I'm here. And I duly arrived and met you.
I do remember you at Cambridge because you were always nipping off London to work for Harper's and Queen and everything. How did you start getting involved in journalism so early and ahead of us all?
I was ill when I was about 16, and I was sent home from school to recuperate. And as I got better, I started to read a magazine called Harper's and Queen, which I had never read before. It was a mag that my mother took. And I found it completely fascinating in all kinds of different ways. I liked very much the blend that it had in it of fashion and serious articles. And to me, reading it at the age of 16, it was very much like a Narnian experience of looking into another world in which I did not at all belong. And yet I found extremely fascinating to look at the wit of the headlines, the smell of the paper, the extraordinarily good design. All of it spoke to me. And as I got better, I wrote handwritten, how amateur is that, an article for it. The article was called How to Survive Hampshire Teenage Parties. And I walked about 3/4 of a mile to the nearest post box And I put it in. Obviously, there was no email. There was everything about this meant it was terribly unlikely to even be read. But it was read by a most remarkable features editor called Anne Barr, who played a very great part in my life.
And you worked with Peter York as well.
She was the co-author of the Sloane Ranger Handbook, and she was the deputy editor of Harpers and Queen, and a very, very great, formidable figure. And she read this article, and she typed it out herself, and she bought it. And I was then asked to come into the office, and I sat with her while we worked, edited together. And then I remember it was coming out in the October issue, and I didn't quite know when it was coming out. And every single afternoon, I walked from here across the bridge up to Windsor, where there is now a Nando's. There used to be a W.H. Smith's. And I waited for the issue to come in. And then I turned to the page, and there was my article in the main well as a double-page typographically designed piece with my byline. And it was a very formative moment of my life, and I then wrote for them a lot and worked there in the holidays, and used to have a 2 days a week at one point while I was at university. So if you noticed, I wasn't there on Wednesdays and Thursdays. That was probably where I was. And so when I left, I was very keen to get into journalism. I hadn't actually considered any other career. I hadn't made any plans. I wasn't sure. It was the first week that I was out of university. And I was reading the Evening Standard, and there in Londoner's Diary, it announced that there was a new editor for the Tatler magazine, and it announced that Tina Brown, who I was aware of because I'd read a lot of her pieces, was being appointed editor at the incredibly young age of 28. And I wrote to her, and I went to be interviewed by her in her. She was the girlfriend at that point of Harry Evans, the editor, yes, of the Sunday Times, and was living with him in a house in Pimlico. And I went round to the house, and there was Tina, very foxy, sitting in the kitchen. And she threw some pictures, social pictures, onto the table. And she said, do you know who these chinless characters are? That was her expression. And I looked, and of course I did know who quite a lot of them were, because they were either people I'd been at university with or had been at school with. So I said, it's that person, that person, that person. And I said, I think these were taken at a party up in Leicestershire at Beaver Castle. She said, yes, you're right, looking interested. And she said, okay, give me a headline. Give me a headline. And it was clearly a test. And I said, Saturday Night Beaver. And
I'm hoping you were going to tell that story. It's such a brilliant headline.
And she said, you're hard. And so I went home and told my parents, with whom I was living, that I had a job. And my parents said, that's marvellous. And what are you going to be paid? I said, I didn't ask. Anyway, I worked for Tina and learned a lot from her and loved those 3 years or 4 years that I was there.
And the rest is history, and you went on to great heights. And I just want to talk to you a bit about magazines, because your book was called The Glossy Years, and of course we've had Raydon Carter's recent book, When the Going Was Good. And I just wonder whether either of you foresaw the changes that were going to happen, because I was listening again to a conversation you and I had during COVID, actually, and you were very confident that although magazines might become more digital, they were going to keep going strong. Do you still think that?
I think I think what I probably said, even 5 years ago, was that those magazines that have a very, very clear DNA and a very clear position in the market, and I think this is particularly true of two types of magazines, news and the top glosses,
yes,
would hang on, because they are able to bring very specific things to the party. With the glossy magazines, and I'm thinking of Vogue, Harper's, Tatler, House and Garden and World of Interiors in particular, yeah, and you will notice if you look at the circulations of them, they've mostly held pretty close to where they were even in the glory days. They're down, but not massively down. the weeklies and the weekly news magazines, they're all holding on as if the digital revolution hadn't come. That said, no, things are not what they were, mostly because of the choice being given to advertisers. You've got to remember that when that a magazine like British Vogue, which was able to command, even going back 5 years, £27,500 for a double page advert, and many of the big brands were taking three consecutive spreads, so even allowing for a slight discount, they were paying considerably more than a year's school fees at Eton to have six sheets of paper.
A Dior or Chanel or a brand like that, do you mean?
Indeed.
Yeah.
And the margin of profit off those pages was extraordinarily high and allowed these magazines to be run to a very high standard with properly staffed and make good money. I mean, the international part of Condé Nast that I was president of and was part of the, spent a lot of my life doing, we, in some years, would make a profit that was very close to or even touched $200 million on a turnover of just a smidgen under $1 billion. So you can see that it's pretty much 20% margin. No businesses have 20% margin, or hardly any but businesses do. So it was a very, very enjoyable time. And I think that it is more challenging now. But I still read a lot of magazines, and I think they still have a place, and I think that they will continue in some form, I hope, the rest of my life. I hope so.
Can we talk about the other industry now that you, of course, were a massive part of, that you also talked about in COVID, because you saw that taking a huge hit, which is, of course, fashion.
I'm not a fashion expert at all, but I did get drawn into quite a lot of these things. I did chair the British Fashion Council for 4 years, which really meant putting on London Fashion Week twice a year. We were doing about 60 shows a year. I think they still are doing 60 shows a year. It was just around the time when the big French conglomerates were starting to buy up British talent. So for a period, we had Alexander McQueen and Stella McCartney as standalone British fashion. Paul Smith, of course, was absolutely key. Then you went right down. Then you had the rise and rise of Burberry. All of those things were quite heavily in my life. Fashion was the fifth biggest industry in Britain.
And that's often overlooked, isn't it?
It used to be enormously overlooked. It was overlooked by the Labour government at that point completely. And actually, even the Conservative government took a bit of time to get their head behind it. And Samantha Cameron actually did some very good stuff about supporting it hugely. And then Fashion Rocks, thank you for remembering it, was the thing that nearly gave me a triple heart attack, which was a charity event we put on. And I must have been completely, absolutely, totally mad and naive to get drawn into it. I got drawn into it because the then Prince of Wales, now the King, asked if I could think of some big event to help them raise money for the Prince's Trust. And in that Pavlovian way that I always say yes to members of the royal family, I heard myself, yes, sir, it'd be a great honour. And what we came up with was an event at the Albert Hall, and it had 18 separate mini fashion shows of all the greatest brands of the world, Dior, Chanel, Ralph Lauren, all of them, Armani, Versace, and at the same time, 18 top rock acts. We got Beyonce, Robbie Williams.
Bowie.
Couldn't be there on the thing, but did a big, wonderful video at the end where all of the models, because we had every supermodel that you have ever heard of, was in it. And it was a cast of about 140 models.
Good Lord.
And these 18 top fashion designers, every one of whom came, apart from John Galliano, who got lost at the station. And then in the interval, there were two intervals, I had to take the Prince of Wales and the Duchess of Cornwall, as she then was, to meet the stars and the designers. And it was simply the most surreal thing that you can ever imagine happening. So I would say, Your Royal Highness, may I present Beyoncé and Donatella Versace? And he would say, oh, very lovely to meet you. And then, then we, and Robbie Williams and this person and that person.
Were they all paired deliberately with a rock star?
The designers.
Yeah.
Gave us a list of the rock stars they would most like us to get. Can you imagine the difficulty of that? Tom Ford with Brian Ferry. How many conversations did I have to have with both? And there is a God, because on the night it worked really well. And it was broadcast in 110 different countries around the world. And it made a lot of money for the Prince's Trust. And it was one of those things that when you've done it, you're so pleased that you've done it.
Yes.
And so relieved and so grateful to the world that it, because it could so easily have all gone wrong.
So let's talk about museums now, because you went, as you said earlier, I think you were chairman of the Victoria and Albert Museum for 10 years.
It was unbelievably enjoyable. I absolutely loved it. It was the museum that I'd always loved before I got involved, because its collections reflect a lot of things that I'm interested in. I collect Georgia, my wife and I collect Indian art, and it's got, of course, a huge fashion collection there. And it has, I like the medieval Renaissance collection there very much as well. And I love the way that it collects modern things, and that it's still a growing collection at a tremendous rate. Mm. And it's got, I think, one of the great Islamic collections there. And yet it collects some. At the same time, it was collecting all the newer Apple iPhones as they came out, and every. I found it just constantly enjoyable and interesting. And I felt I had two different directors while I was there. First, Martin Roth, who did was coming to his final 3 years. And then we had a very lucky break in that we chose Tristram Hunt, and I liked him at once. And he turned out to be absolutely first rate. And it allowed the museum, we completed the building of the V&A in Dundee, and then enormous parts of South Kensington were redone, and money was raised, and new, it's about 85% of all of the 7 miles of galleries have now been updated and redone. And then there were a succession of major blockbuster exhibitions.
Dior,
Chanel, David Bowie, Pink Floyd, Alexander McQueen. And it's such an enjoyable, big cultural juggernaut. And it was a very, very happy time. And then I reached an interesting point in my life, because I thought I was going... I thought all the things I was doing, I was retiring from them.
You were and never going to retire, were you?
That was my plan, yes.
No,
it went was
wrong.
Very, very sorry. It has gone very badly awry, actually. it has. My plan had been to rent for 4 or 5 months a year a house on the beach in India and spend a lot of time sunbathing and swimming.
Yes, you love India.
I do love it. But actually what sort of happened was they were looking for candidates to chair historic royal palaces, and they said, did I want to be one? And they always ask about 8 people. And I thought it'd be a very interesting thing to do, because I love Hampton Court, and I think the Tower of London is fascinating. There was a lot of very interesting work happening at Kensington Palace and at Kew. I was very impressed what they were doing there. And the Banqueting House in Whitehall, which is being totally redone at the moment. And then Hillsborough Castle in Northern Ireland, which is another whole story in itself, and is where the great Good Friday Agreement was made, and has some of the most beautiful gardens. If you haven't been, I so recommend it. So I put my hat in the ring, but it overlapped, strangely enough, with a rather similar process that was happening for Eton, and my predecessor, the great Lord Wargrave, I was having lunch with him, and he said, towards the end of lunch, could I think of any suggestions of people who might be good to be his successor as provost? And I made three terribly good suggestions. And then he said, oh, your own name has been mentioned once or twice by people. Would you be prepared?
Have you not thought about it until that moment?
No.
Really?
And he
not?
Said, would you like to... but this was 2 or 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. Would you be prepared to be on my shortlist of 15 or 20 names? Well, I thought, first, it'd be very rude to say no, since we were having lunch. And secondly, I mean, I'm perfectly aware that quite well-qualified people tend to be interested in doing the role. And anyway, so time moved on, and I was asked if I would like to come and be interviewed. And I did an hour and a half interview, and then a few days later, somebody rang up and said, I have good news. You're in the final 10. Would you like to come back again? So I came back again. And they rang again and said, good news, you're in the final 5.
And
our next interview was at Apsley House in London. We're having a London set, so I went to that. And then I got a message to say that there were 3 left. And at this point, I said to Georgia, my wife, I said, gosh, we better actually have a serious conversation with each other, because although now it's 1 in 3, but I said it would look rather rude to say no if now we've got this far in. And she thought it'd be fun. And I think she was completely right. And so it has proved to be. I mean, it's a funny thing, isn't it, about as one gets slightly older. I notice it with my friends. I think it's unwise to go cold turkey and to suddenly stop doing things. You see people declining quite quickly sometimes, not all, but if they do. One of the lovely things about being here is that it's inspiring, actually, and highly enjoyable that there are so many intelligent young men around. And there's an enormous number of people who teach here who are highly intelligent. There's quite a civilised atmosphere. And the place is beautiful.
It certainly is.
I mean, it just is. The foundation buildings here, the houses, which haven't really changed externally at all, the playing fields, the gardens here, which are kept to a very high standard, all of these things are largely unchanged. Then, of course, in many ways, the school's changed hugely. I would say that the atmosphere is warmer than it would have been, although, having said that, I was very happy here. There's a very interesting mix of boys here. I would say that there's a very large number who are very familiar to the kind of boys who were here all those years ago. But the school is more interesting now because there are more international students. America being the number one country from which boys come here.
Really? How many Americans are here?
There's 70 at the moment.
Gosh, that's a lot.
There are the second largest number from China, predominantly Hong Kong. Then there's about 40 from India. And there are just a few fewer than that. There are some from the Middle East. There are some, of course, from continental Europe. And which takes you to the grand total of the 1,346 boys that are here, the 1,164 staff, and the 18,000 highly opinionated alumni. When there's these reunions for boys who left, we had one the other day for boys who left 60 years ago, so they were all people in their late 70s and coming into their 80s. an enormous number turned up. They're allowed to bring their wives when they get to, when they're 80 or 78, so they can drive them home afterwards. they were, what a most charming group of people they were too.
In your role as Provost, Nick, do you see yourself as the nurturer and protector of the school's core values, whatever you identify them as? Or do you see yourself as somebody who might like to ring some changes during your time here?
Well, I think Eton is always playing for a long game, isn't it? It's been going since 1440, and at different times it goes this way and that. I suspect my own views are highly centrist, by which I mean that I like and appreciate quite a lot of the traditional things about here. Mm-hmm. I am not against the uniform. I think that the various things that are done with speeches, which is a tradition here where boys learn things off by heart and give the most mesmerizing speeches. So I like all of that. The headmaster and the leadership team run the school day to day. I certainly don't feel that it is either my role, it isn't my role to tell boys off or anything. I expect if I saw somebody smoking behind a tree out of the window, I just wouldn't look too hard and would move on. That's not my role. But yes, I think there is an extent to which the Provost of Eton is a guardian of some of its enduring strengths, and I very much hope that I don't muck it up.
Very, very good answer. So now, before I let you go, let's just talk a bit about you personally, because during all your this immense career of yours, you've had time to write all these books, which you mentioned you wrote your first ever article for Harper's by hand, but you write your books by hand too, don't you?
I do, yeah. I think if I was 20 years younger, I would be able to think and type at the same time. And I have tried writing at length on screen, and of course I write memos and emails on screen. But I find that I write better when I'm writing on those large American-style yellow pads.
Yes.
With green Pentel pens is my system. I'm not writing at the moment, and I'm not missing it at the moment, but I'm sure I will again at some point.
Well, let's just quickly go from that into what we were saying before we started today about a lot of our friends, because we have known each other a very, very long time. And how do you envisage the majority of your friends now?
I went back to a reunion at Trinity at Cambridge, and I hadn't been to one thing. And I thought that we did slightly divide into those who were still working and did, I think, seem slightly more alert, and those who'd been retired for a bit, either because they had made enough money to retire and decided that they wanted to, or because the jobs that they were doing had run out of rope and came to an end. And I think one has to fight against that. But we are entering, we have to be completely aware, a decade now where illness, which I've never thought about illness ever, is beginning to be a factor amongst some of our friends. And it's a lottery, isn't it?
Yes.
You just have to, I think, do your best to, this is rather a cliche, is it not, to say to enjoy every day. But actually, I do think it's good to. There's a terrible thing for, I think, for men especially, that if you've been doing quite a full-on job that's involved you getting into the office early and working till late, and if you're suddenly at home, and people often have a dream of selling somewhere where they've worked and lived in London, and they just simply long to be in Suffolk, miles as far away from anywhere as possible, and then their lives close in quite quickly.
Do you think you're still able to be immensely active, partly because you've talked in the past about your discipline. You used never to allow yourself to yawn or complain of jet lag and you had your routine when you were doing all your flying around the world, you would have your two Bloody Marys and then a kip. you know yourself very well, don't you, to discipline yourself.
I did do all those things. And actually, the one challenge I have here at Eton is that I try to get out in the afternoons for an hour and a half walk, because I like to go up either to the playing fields and do a complete circuit, or I like sometimes, if I'm in the mood for a much longer walk, to walk to what is called the Copper Horse, which is in the middle of Windsor Great Park, which I happen to know is 17,200 footsteps from the back door of the Vice Provost Lodge where we're living at the moment. And I like to do 10,000 a day. And because there are an enormous number of things that get into my diary here, and it does have a tendency to encroach.
But never mind. I can walk up and down College Chapel as I read the lesson instead and get a few hundred footsteps in there.
Well, you've had a very full and active life, Nick. Do you have any regrets?
Do I have any regrets? No, I don't. I think I've been quite lucky to find enough things that I like doing. And, of course, the key decisions you make are what job you decide to do, who you decide to marry, and if your children come out good. And on the whole, I've been quite lucky in the friends that we've made over the years and who've stayed. I still have that once a year lunch with six people you know very well.
I've been to that lunch.
You joined us once. It's very rare for us to have a guest member. It started 3 years after we left university, and it has always taken place in that same Chinese restaurant in Wardour Street. And the waiters have never once recognised us in all that time. You know, we return, it's always thing. And it's, I mean, it's just, even though we've been quite some years, we've been twice a year to this. It's always a table of six or seven or eight. Anyway, I hope we will be going to the Jade Garden, which is what it's called, although it recently changed its name to the Orient, which was a shock for everybody, but we still go to it.
And what have you got in the immediate 2 weeks ahead here at Eton? You're in the about to embark on A-levels, are you? And
then, well, the boys are. Isn't that a lovely thing about being grown up, not having to do it? For a long time after I left school, whenever the weather got hot around this time of the year, I got that sort of exam panic. And then I remembered, of course, one's never going to have to do exams, I hope, ever again. But what have I got coming?
4th of June? Tell our listeners all about that.
Well, the 4th of June, which is Eton's annual, I don't think you'd use the word sports day, but it's got an important game of cricket going on, and then it has the famous procession of boats, and parents bring picnics, and there could be anything up to about, I suppose, 6,000 or 7,000 people there. It covers the entire playing fields, and it has always been, it's gone through different phases, but it's, I think, probably still remains one of the high days and holidays. And the rowing is still continuing big time. People play a lot of fives here. They play a lot of rackets. The Eton Chronicle, dare I say it, may be better written than it was even in my day. It's less gossipy now. It used to be more gossipy. It's
still you and Craig Brown.
Yes, does that amaze you? It has a gossip column still called The Jackal, but I think they probably take a quick squint at it before it goes to press to cross out anything that's too rude. And anyway, it's a very happy school. If I had, I'm sometimes asked if I would recommend it, and I would unhesitatingly do so.
What a great place to end. That's absolutely fantastic. Nick Coleridge, thank you so much for being on Radio Oldham.
Thank you.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with Nick Coleridge. If you've enjoyed listening to us and want to hear more like this, please go to www.theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. My very warm thanks again to you, Nick Coleridge, to Bailey Gifford for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye. You've been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.